Hi, everyone. Welcome back. I'm here with Laura Doherty. How about you introduce yourself to our audience? Super excited to have you on, by the way.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. You know, everybody loves the experience of speaking with you, Zach, so I'm happy to be included. Thank you. I live in Baltimore. I've lived here for 26 years, but I'm the daughter of a special educator who used direct instruction in Idaho back in the 70s. She was one of the people who had the corrective reading pages when they were in newsprint, and she was teaching her kids in summer school how to read with corrective reading. And then I went to the University of Oregon as a grad student for a behavioral disorder program. And while I was there, I just hooked up with Jerry Silbert and Doug Carnine and switched to instruction. So and now I've been here ever since. And we now have a third generation DI person in our family because my daughter is at a DI school teaching fifth grade reading.
That's awesome. And many people will know about your work with the Baltimore Curriculum Project, or we're probably going to abbreviate it to BCP again and again in this episode. Do you mind telling us about what is the Baltimore Curriculum Project?
The Baltimore Curriculum Project started 30 years ago. We're in our 38th year as a reading program. I mean, it was an attempt by a foundation to either bring or create the best reading program in the world to Baltimore, to use in Baltimore City Public Schools. And our founder, Dr. Muriel Berkeley, worked with the ABLE Foundation, and she kind of set out on a research project to see what was out there as she prepared to write her own curriculum. And then she ran into direct instruction through, I think, Project Follow Through, and spoke with Zig, went and visited a school in Utah and said, okay, I don't need to write a curriculum. This is what we need to use. And we've been here ever since. So that was 30 years ago.
What really impressed me about the Baltimore Curriculum Project was at the last NIFTY National Direct Instruction Conference, you were out in full force. Like it was like half or more of the entire audience was BCP. There's something about the culture and the warmth of you folks that it was just really heartwarming and special. Tell us a little bit about that.
I think we're lucky in that we have people who were with us at the beginning that are still around. And I think that's a testament to the power of the programs and the success that people feel when they're involved in these programs, where you can really be successful and see kids be successful year after year. So we have teachers who start as brand new teachers who become very good at it, and they move into coaching positions, and then they move into school leadership positions. So it just goes on and on because, well, one, we know how to support teachers and make them successful, and then people want to stay in that world using direct instruction.
What exact programs do you use for the BCP that are direct instruction programs?
Some of our schools are pre-K-5 and some of them are pre-K-8. So all of them use direct instruction reading mastery. We typically use the signatures version for K-1, and then we switch to the transformations versions from second through fifth. We also use the language program. So in pre-K, we're using the signatures version of the K language program. And then at some point, we transition into the transformations language program. We use CMCA and Distar Arithmetic, starting in pre-K, CMCA, sometimes CMCB, sometimes CMCC in like our special ed classes. And we also use expressive writing if kids come to us and they're not firm on their narrative writing skills. And we use corrective reading up through eighth grade if kids need it.
It was interesting to like be in a corrective math, corrective reading training at this NIFTY conference, and to see some of your folks who, because of having exposure to other programs, their delivery was so much more crisp than mine. I noticed they were really skilled already when they were going to like a second or third program. I want to know, like, when you walk into a BCP classroom during a DI lesson, like, what do you see and hear that kind of makes it so distinctive?
Well, it looks different at the different grade levels, of course, but so we'll start in the lower grades where typically we have a teacher and a paraprofessional, both in the same room, and usually three instructional groups. So there's a group in one corner teaching read with a teacher teaching reading, a group in another corner where the paraprofessional is teaching language, and then there's a group at their desks or at stations, appropriate stations, doing independent work or working on some stations. So that would be pre-KK for until they get into the second grade program, and then the reading instruction, of course, goes to the whole group. And well, in all of the classrooms, you really should see 100% engagement. Like, kids are involved in their learning, they're participating, they're responding, they're being successful, because we take great care to put kids into situations where they're going to be successful, and while learning, they enjoy it. So kids like to be successful. They like to know that they're learning, and so when you're in those classrooms, you see high rates of success and a lot of engagement. And we train teachers to recognize the things that the kids are doing that you like and name them and talk about them. We teach that very explicitly. We take data on kind of positive statements where you're recognizing what kids are doing well, versus corrective statements like, oh, I need you to touch part three, because sometimes corrective statements can be very kindly delivered, but they still go in the negative column because you're not recognizing the kids that are doing it. Oh, I love how Mary touched part three so quickly. That there's a difference. So we teach teachers how to get more of the behaviors that you want by recognizing them, and eliminate the behaviors you don't want by ignoring them. And so you see a lot of just positive interactions in our rooms.
And what sort of like student population are we talking about? I mean, are these generally kids that are from more wealthy backgrounds, or like what does the project what population of kids is this really serving?
We have one school that has a fair number of middle class kids. That's the one. That is one of the highest performing school in the city right now, Hampstead Hill. And then we have our other schools have anywhere from nearly 100% poverty to 70% poverty. So they're economically disadvantaged kids. We have something that are called we run conversion charter schools. And so they're existing public schools that serve all of the kids in their enrollment zone. And in order to convert to become a conversion charter school, you have to be basically poorer than the typical school in your LEA and lower performing. So we take on schools that want and need this kind of support, and work really hard to make everybody successful.
I want to think about the teacher perspective, because direct instruction, with the scripts, with the choral response, with the very systematic approach, with error corrections and so on, it can just look weird to like an outsider who's never used it. And so I'm sure you get a lot of, new teachers that come out of teacher training programs that perhaps had like unproductive views of how to teach. How do you onboard folks? How do you convince them and persuade them that this is the way to go?
Well, we're in a good position in that we've been doing this long enough that if anybody is curious, they can come and see what it looks like. And because we've been doing this a long time, we have teachers who, if you didn't know it was scripted, you wouldn't know it was scripted, because they're just very natural with it. It's just a practically a two-way conversation with the kids. And choral responses, they're not new to DEA. I mean, the world has been using them for a long time, and we just use them in a way that is really precise. But people know what they're getting into at this point when they join a DEI school. And so when they come to interview, they observe a class, and we can answer any questions, but they know that they will get training and they will be teaching direct instruction.
I'm kind of jealous of that, even just that setup, because it seems like education is just like it values like this marketplace of ideas type of thing. And
Yeah.
so you come in and you get to do you and I get to do me, and we all get to choose our own adventure. And then in the end, the kids don't get the predictable experience with like a systematic program that builds on itself when everybody's kind of doing their own thing.
Yeah. People, teachers need to bring themselves to their practice, and you walk into three different rooms and you should see three different personalities, really. But that doesn't apply to instructional design. The instructional design has to be something that is effective and has been proven to be effective, and the creativity and the fun can come into the day, well, into the lesson with how you reinforce the kids, how you interact with the kids. And there's a whole lot of that school day that isn't direct instruction. So if you have some things you really want to do in the science or the social studies lessons with projects, okay. But when it comes down to the real nitty-gritty of moving kids from non-readers to reading novels, there are things that are more effective than others, and we're going to use them.
I want to talk about that a little bit because I think a lot of us can appreciate what it's like to learn from any phonics program when you're like in kindergarten. But like, what does it look like in the student's journey through direct instruction once you get into like the upper levels of reading? Like, how does it seem like the experience shifts?
The experience shifts from mostly teacher-led to mostly student-independent. So at the fifth grade level of the Reading Mastery books, there's word attack that's done as a group with some introduction of new vocabulary. There's a little bit of reading that's done as a group, and then most of the story is read independently, and the kids are expected to be able to respond independently to the questions. And there's a lot more writing involved at the upper levels. They still use, model lead test paradigm with new vocabulary, new like standards instruction when you're teaching figurative language. They still model lead test, but the kids are expected by the end of fifth grade to be pretty independent learners, able to take in information on their own and process it and work with it.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I want to explore, like in future episodes of this podcast, is like what it looks like in the upper levels of Reading Mastery. Because, like, what are we working towards? And how does the design sort of build up to that kind of complex performance that so many of us want? I mean, what do you feel like as you send these kids off to middle school, like that they can do that perhaps someone that wasn't in direct instruction can do?
Well, they should be able to handle grade level material when they go. So they should be able to read and access the English curriculum, the science curriculum, the social studies curriculum, and be confident. Like a lot of advantage I think our kids have is they have been successful in school. When you've been successful in school, you enter a new school with a confidence and an attitude of, I'm going to do well here, versus I've struggled for years. This is just a year, another year of struggling, and I don't like struggling. I don't like not, I don't like being unsuccessful. And they can't access the material. But when kids leave us above, on, or slightly, below where we want them to be, they should be able to go to middle school or high school and be successful in what's expected of them.
There's this feel of in the culture of the participants that came to the Nifty conference that I've you received an award by Nifty for like long time recognition in the direct instruction community. But then like there were tears in the room, there were people standing up and cheering and jumping up and down. I mean, like, how do you explain that?
Well, there is a real community around direct instruction. And like I said, some of the people that are with us now have been with us for this whole journey. And a lot of the people in that room in Eugene got me started. They're, Jerry Silbert. I wouldn't be here without Jerry. And you just feel a debt of gratitude to the people who led you to where you are, especially when you love what you're doing. And I love what I'm doing. Most of the people in that room love what they're doing, and it makes everybody feel good and feel emotional when it's talked about, because it is hard work. I mean, it will never be easy, and that's okay because we know what to do. But when you work really hard year after year, like teachers do, you appreciate the chance to celebrate and acknowledge success and people who've helped you get there.
There's this sense of like of mission and also just a feeling of urgency that I got out of the Nifty conference that I don't think people really associate with direct instruction. I mean, it's technical, there's scripts, there's data, you know, if there's precision, there's groupings and measurement and things like that. But the whole, everybody that I talk to from your crew just loves kids and wants to make a difference in this world and use every minute to, like, you know, make up for lost time for some of these kids. It's just really incredible.
I think part of that comes from putting teachers into a situation where they can be successful. If a teacher goes, if there's a new teacher and she's put into a situation where she doesn't have support and it doesn't feel successful, that's hard to like. And so we really want to make sure that we're giving new teachers the training and the support they need so that they can see their progress and see their kids' progress. And it just makes people want to come back for more.
I have this theory. There's no evidence behind this, but I have this theory that if you started with DI, or at least you had a mid-career DI experience like I did, that it shapes how you would teach, even if you were doing a lesson that is not with a DI program. I'm curious, as you've worked with so many different teachers, if you've heard stories like this, of them going to a different district, maybe coming back and so on, and how this experience shapes them as professionals.
Well, that's absolutely the case. And even they don't even have to move. They can be teaching social studies or science, and they use group responses or they use Model E tests. And so that some of the techniques that are, throughout the DI programs, you can use in other programs. You just have to put a lot of thought and energy into where and when and what that you don't have to do. The mid-career, the new versus mid-career, we see new people come in and be successful. But what's really fun sometimes is when you convert a school and start using direct instruction, and teachers see the difference. And there's one teacher in particular, Ms. Henson, who I think I acknowledged during the award at NIFTY. She was, you know, just a good person, a good citizen, and she taught pre-K, and she had, you know, I would say typical expectations in pre-K of the kids. And after the first year of DI, she said, "Laura, I have never had kids reading sentences before. I have never had kids adding and subtracting before." And she said, "When my kids opened that storybook up and stuck their fingers in and read those sentences, I cried. So and then this year, after 4 years, she got two of her groups all the way through the K program in pre-K. And so that to her was a revelation after doing something one way for so many years. And she saw what a difference it made, but she was open to it. You know, she's been teaching for quite a while, and she was open to learning something new. So anyway, those are some of the most fun experiences, is when teachers who have been doing it one way suddenly do it a new way. And just, they're some of our best advocates, but, you know, we have a lot of good luck with first year teachers trying to, you know, make sure that they're successful and moving kids.
We talked about the teachers and their experience, but, like, there's something else I've alluded to in this podcast a lot, is this compounding effect for the students, where do you see a difference between a student who's had multiple years in the programs versus a student who just comes right into the school, like, kind of, you know, fish out of water, and is just trying to, for the first time, grapple with, like, a systematic approach to learning?
Yeah, that we've definitely seen a difference with kids who have been with us for multiple years on how they performed on the, you know, the state test. Like, it's just like three times more likely if they've been with us for at least 3 years. So we have that kind of data. But we also see kids who may come in with a not great attitude towards school because they haven't been successful. And then they go to a reading group where suddenly they can read that word. They can, you know, they can do this. And it does change them. They learn a new way to think about themselves as a student, and they see themselves learning. And so when people say, "Oh, kids feel kids might feel funny going to, you know, walking to another room to get reading because they know they, well, you know, what they really hate is being in a room where they can't do what's being asked of them." That's really hard on a kid. So when you have these, you know, pullout groups that get some of the foundational skills improved, sometimes they're, you know, I've seen kids who in their reading group are absolute dreams, and then in the lunchroom, less so. because they like being in good instruction that makes them see that they're learning.
I guess kind of the third corner of that triangle then is parents, because you mentioned like there's like the conversion school model, and there's also parents may not understand like how this all works, the funding and the structures of schools and things like that. And in addition to that, the child comes home and says like, yeah, like I don't know, we're doing in this reading group, and I switched to this one, and we do, you know. How do you communicate this to parents, or are they largely just kind of go with the flow and appreciate some of the gains that you're reporting?
If parents come in pre-K or K, there's a lot of orientation about here's what we use, here's what it looks like. We have nights where parents can come and see the curriculum and get trained in the sounds if they want to reinforce them at home. If parents come to us from another school, in third or fourth or fifth on up, we have to we tell them that we're going to test their child, see how what they're where they are with their reading, and then explain the results to them. And so you really have to communicate, and you can show them how the kid did on a grade level passage. You can show them how they did in where you ended up placing them. And but what you have to, if they end up above level, well, there's really no problem. But if they end up below grade level, then you have to have a plan for them. You have to say, here's where your kid is starting. Here's where we need them to be, and here's our plan to get them there. If we just start them there, then we'll be in the same situation probably at the end of the year as we are now. It's too much of a challenge, and they just get frustrated. So you can't just say your child is a year and a half below grade level, and they're going to end up a year and a half below grade level. You need to have an acceleration plan, and so that's part of what we do is really carefully monitoring our groups to make sure that if anybody is in a below level program, what are we doing to catch them up? And it's the corrective reading does that. There are some acceleration schedules built into some of the other programs, so that you can do more than a lesson a day. And of course the kids have to maintain their mastery levels, but we can do that.
It's fantastic, and I'm hoping that I hoping I can come over and visit pretty soon. Like,
Oh
I think it would be
yes.
pretty fun. Is there anything else that you want people to know about your work and about the Baltimore Curriculum Project before we sign out?
Well, I think what's extraordinary about BCP is how long we stuck with this. And I think it's a testament to DI because this is our 30th year. I'm the second CEO. I'm the second leader. And so the first one was there for 16 years and I'm entering my 14th. It's just and we and it has that kind of longevity because we haven't wavered in our commitment to direct instruction reading and language. It's just that's the engine that makes us go. And right now we have six schools. And when Muriel first got this going, I think at one point we had 20 some schools, and they made a DI district in Baltimore, and it had the support of, they had their own superintendent, and then they got a new CEO. And then, it's just all of the changes that happen at a district level and every district in the country. And even at a school level, when a principal changes, we've been able to overcome that because of our structure. We're Baltimore Curriculum Project. We run these schools, and both Muriel and I just know that this is what makes us special and makes us successful. And so we've been able to stick with it.
Love it, and keep sticking with it, and hopefully 25 years from now you get the, I don't know what the, you got the Silver Star Award, maybe you'll get the platinum
Yeah, I think I
the
have it in here somewhere, but yeah.
award. Laura, it was so wonderful to have you on the podcast. People are looking for sort of lighthouse schools and lighthouse school districts who are sticking with their principals, working with systematic materials and implementing instruction that really works for kids. Listeners, I really appreciate you tuning in, and I'd love for you to spread this podcast around to a principal, to a colleague, get it out there. And I know you can help me by spreading the news. This podcast is just a labor of love, and I really appreciate it. Laura, thank you so much. Take care.
Well, thank you, Zach. It's been a real pleasure. Keep on doing what you're doing. We need it.